Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for March 3rd. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and with me in cyberspace is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
Oh, not a whole heck of a lot. Nice, peaceful Sunday evening. How about yourself?
The weather fooled me. I thought it was going to spring up on us. Get it? Spring up on us. And then...
That's a play on words.
Or something. And it got cold again, but I'm hanging in there.
Okay.
All right. This week on the show, we've got an interview with former Swallows and Marine slugger Josh Weitzel. We're going to talk about camp and answer our great listener question. So let's get started.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so I talked to Josh Weitzel last week it would be now. Now, he joined the Swallows in midseason. Well, not really midseason, but just after the season started in 2010, and he stayed with them for 2 years. And you said he did well numbers-wise in 2010?
Yeah, before they changed the ball, he played in 68 games, and he hit .309. But, you can see the difference between playing in Jingu and playing in Lotte in 2012 when – he also hit .309, and he had pretty much exactly the same season, except he scored 20 fewer runs in Chiba in 2012, and he drove in 10 fewer runs, and he had exactly the same batting average. He had 3 fewer walks. It was like they were like 2 perfectly identical seasons, except one was with a lively ball and a better ballpark.
Right. So he went over to Chiba in 2012, and the only thing I remember about that year was he clanked a couple of catchers on the head with his backswing, and we discussed that on the show, and he ended up getting sent down. And then last year he had the problem with his hand, an injury that kept him out for a little while, and during the time that he was out, the Marines went and got Craig Brazel, who's a big left-handed hitting power hitter, just like Josh. So as you'll hear in the interview, he states that there wasn't really a place for him in the batting lineup, and he didn't get any play and was released at the end of the season. And he's headed off to Mexico, he says. So, I remember you talking about Josh and how he has this analytical approach, and that sometimes you guys think the same, and I'm going to ask, you'll hear me talk with him about that in the interview, but hopefully you can explain a little bit or expound on that a little bit too. But he's in California now. He said he had some time with his family before he heads off to Mexico, so let's go ahead and take a listen to the interview. All right, our special guest this week is Josh Weitzel. How are you doing, buddy?
Doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, except for the U.S. losing in hockey and both the women's and men's in the Olympics. I'm doing all right, but I'll get over it, I guess.
Oh, the women's one was depressing.
Especially at 4 o'clock when you wake up to watch the end, and that's all you see. But anyway, what happened with your injury last year, and where are you now, and where are you headed?
This is kind of a freak thing. I took a swing at a breaking ball in the dirt, and just felt a little kind of tweak in my thumb and kind of in that region. And, it was just wouldn't get better. And, by the time that I finally did get healthy for the second half of the season, the team had picked up Craig Brazel, and then he was playing well, so there really was no spot for me. So I was healthy the whole second half, but just unfortunately there was no, with the full roster limit, there was no spot. And so now I'm going to start the year in Mexico and perform well and find myself back in the MPB.
All right. So, yeah, Mexico, have you played there before?
No, I haven't. I've played in the Dominican Republic, never in Mexico.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Now, how would you classify your time with Chiba, and why are we not seeing you here now?
I really liked it. I thought they were a really good organization. They gave me an opportunity, and I was, was really, really enjoyed the city there, and the fans in Chiba are some of the best in the league, if not the best. And the support that they show their team is night in and night out. It's amazing, and the support is something that helps spur that team on and really to perform better.
I believe it. The first time I went out to a game at Chiba and saw that the fans doing the dance or the jumping and all that stuff, it was really impactful for me, and it stayed with me for a long time. That was 2005 that I actually got to experience that up close and personal. So That has always stayed with me. Now, from the time that you came to Japan and throughout your time that you've been that you played here, what adjustments to your swing or your approach did you make, or did you have to constantly make?
Well, you're always trying to improve on a daily basis, and every day you're working on something. As far as improvements to your swing, you know, you're working on a daily basis to always improve your swing. And, you know, for me, it's being short to the ball and being direct to the ball and trying to simplify things so that I can be as consistent as possible. And for the league, the adjustments is just getting to learn the pitchers and learn the catchers and just get a feel for how teams are trying to attack you, and then you make adjustments and they make adjustments, and it's a little bit of that chess game where you're trying to stay one step ahead of them.
Was there something that you had to constantly tweak, whether it was your approach or whether it was just your swing?
Nothing in particular. There's times when you feel like, you know, maybe you're opening up, or maybe your timing's a little off, or, you know, you're dropping your back shoulder, little things like that, that you're always going to be keeping an eye on and talking with the hitting coaches and working with the coaches to make sure that you're staying as consistent as possible, because that's really the battle with baseball is playing every day. You want to be as consistent night in and night out so that you can produce at the highest level.
Right, right. Now, your first team, the Yakult Swallows, they finished in last in 2013. Is their system of getting all these little speedy water bug type guys a winning formula in Japan, and especially in that stadium?
I think it can be. I think the biggest thing with the Swallows last year was just the injury bug got them a little bit with their pitching staff. They lost their ace when Tatsuyama went down, and Yoshinori was hurt, and so, you know, you really need pitching. Pitching is what can propel teams to the playoffs, and having, you know, two of their top pitchers out to injury was hurting them. And so, you know, pitching and defense, but the saying goes that pitching and defense wins championships, and it's a saying for a reason, that you need a good staff in order to really get far, get to the playoffs, and then get deep into the playoffs.
Yeah, I believe that. I'm concerned that they keep going after little guy. They get maybe a couple power hitters, and then everybody else is like the same kind of a cookie cutter slap and run guy. And, you know, in a stadium where you can really get a lot of offensive production, I'm just not sure that's a winning formula for that stadium.
Well, it can be. I mean, as long as those guys don't fall into prolonged slumps and they're getting on base at a good clip and stealing bases to get themselves into scoring position, they should be able to score enough runs. So as long as their pitching staff is healthy and pitching the way they should be, then they're going to have a chance to win a lot of ball games. It's just when you have 2-3 starters possibly go down to injury. I know, you know, Tatsuyama, Yoshinori, and then Barnett was hurt for a portion, and was it last year or the year before that?
Yeah, it's been 2 years. 2 years in a row where the injury bug is just—it's just lived off of them.
Yeah, so I don't want to put too much emphasis on that part of the equation when I feel like the injury bug on the pitching part has been what has hurt them, and you know, they have the talent and the players to be a very good team as long as they stay healthy.
Okay. All right, I trust you. Now, Jim often praises your analytic approach to the game. Now, what kinds of numbers do you examine, and how do you incorporate what you learn from those numbers into your game?
Well, I look at different numbers for the pitchers, like whether they're a guy that's going to try to strike you out or a guy that's going to pitch to contact. And then for myself, I just want my on-base percentage and my slugging percentage are the two most important numbers, because I want to be getting on base where I'm not chasing bad pitches out of the zone. I'm taking my walks, and then I'm also slugging percentage is basically hitting the ball hard. So you want to be patient and aggressive at the same time. It's a little bit of both, where you're able to play that chess game with the pitcher and wait out and get your pitch, and when you do, you're able to do damage with it.
Exactly. What kinds of numbers do you look at the pitcher? Do you look at how often they throw certain pitches in the zone, or do you
– No, more just the – strikeout ratio, walk ratio, and then just watching video and just kind of try to get a feel for their tendencies and how they're going to pitch me. It wouldn't do me much good to watch to see how, you know, how they're pitching Honda Yuichi. You know, I want to watch how they're going to be pitching, you know, Brazil or, you know, some of the other guys that are driving the ball. And so I'll try to watch how they're going to attack the power hitters, and then also just whether they're a strikeout guy and their control in general, how many guys they're going to walk. If it's a guy that's, you know, maybe walks four guys for nine innings, then, you know, it's somebody that I'm going to have to be more patient with. But if he only walks, you know, one and a half or two per nine, then it's a guy that's going to be around the zone a lot. I'm going to have to be a lot more aggressive.
Mm. But it sounds to me that more so than the numbers, you look at relying on the video and different aspects of the guy more so than the numbers alone.
It's more of an ever-changing approach of how they're pitching me and how I performed in that situation, in those situations, and then to know what's in their arsenal basically, so that I can be one step ahead of how they're going to change, and so I know what's coming after I've already had success, so I can continue to have success.
Okay. Obviously, Masahiro Tanaka was the biggest news here and stateside for a little while, at least in the offseason. What was your take on him and the whole posting system and how it played out? And I know you chimed in on the homepage. Thank you for that. But what was your whole take on the whole process and everything?
Well, I mean, he obviously is an amazing pitcher and had an unbelievable year last year. And as far as the posting, I just felt like it was kind of like the perfect fit for the way the posting system changed. And then, you know, him being such a amazing talent that teams were, once the maximum of 20 million was set on the system, that to most of these major league clubs is, you know, it's not much money. So what happened was it enabled him to enter basically as a free market free agent. Mm-hmm. So then you had multiple teams bidding on him, and they were a lot of the big market teams, and it really drove the price up, and it showed, he got basically free market value for his talents when a guy like Darvish wasn't able to, because he could only negotiate with one team.
Well, I've been arguing with Jim that they overpaid for Tanaka. What you're saying sounds to me that you agree that they overpaid for him.
Yeah. So you're arguing that the Yankees overpaid for him?
Yes, I am.
I would kind of argue that there is no such thing as an overpay, and that they have that money. They paid what they felt he was worth to be able to obtain his services. And, given his track record of success and his age, you know, once he was put in a free market environment, that showed basically what his value was. And so there's no overpay there.
Yeah, but you just said that it drove the price up, the fact that he was able to negotiate with two teams. So that sounds to me like it wasn't necessarily the price that he was worth, but it was the price that they paid, which sounds to me like they overpaid.
No, I guess I'm saying that Darvish wasn't able to obtain what his true value was because of the old system, where Tanaka was able to, because he was basically an unrestricted free agent, when Darvish was only able to negotiate with the sole team that won his rights.
Okay. All right. Now, do you know what you were in 2012 off of Makun, off of Tanaka? Do you remember the numbers?
I want to say I was 4-7.
With?
But the year before, I was 0-4.
Well, yeah, but in 2012, you were exactly. I'm amazed how you guys always get these things right. You were 4-7.
Two doubles and two singles. I remember, because I remember almost all my at-bats against everybody. It's kind of one of those mental video recorders that you, once you face certain pitchers, you can remember. Even if sometimes you forget their name, you remember their mechanics, their windup, and the pitches you saw.
Ah.
And, two doubles and two singles.
All right, so based on what you saw of him, how well do you think he'll do this season in the American League East, which is a really difficult division, but with the Yankees team that has probably is going to have an unsteady defense on the infield?
Boy, that is the toughest question, because, I mean, obviously Tanaka is an unbelievable talent, and he has pitched so well in the MPB. A lot of it's going to be how he transitions and how he adapts to the environment. I would definitely expect him to be successful. The level of successfulness, I mean, who knows? Is he going to be a number three? Is he going to be a number one? It's so difficult to tell. I guess if I had to say, I would say he'd be a strong number two, and that he would be a very good pitcher for a very good team. But CeCe Sabathia would probably still be the number one of that staff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's hard to, I'm not asking you to put wins and losses on it. I'm just, you know, looking to see if you think he's going to be able to make the adjustments and be consistent. And that's a very difficult, division actually to go over and play. And then again, that defense that he's going to have on the infield, I think is going to be ever changing. Let's just put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the toughest question. And, you know, I think he's going to do well. You know, how well, it's just, you know, one of those things where we're going to have to wait and see.
All right, yeah, we're all looking, you know, everyone with bated breath, I think, is going to watch. We're going to all try to tune in and see what happens. Even if you can't tune in, you're going to jump on your mobile device and see what he did and look at the numbers.
I'm just as interested as everybody else. I want to see.
Yeah, we do too. All right, well, good luck with your work down in Mexico. And what's the name of the team again you're going to be playing with?
Saltillo de Sadaperos.
It sounds good when you say it. I'm not even going to try.
I think that's how you say it. So hopefully I go down and, you know, play well. And you know, I really enjoyed my time in the NPB. And you know, I feel like I can still produce at a very high level. And I look forward to hopefully getting another opportunity soon.
And we look forward to seeing you over here, buddy.
All right, thanks, John.
All right, we appreciate you taking the time. Thanks so much.
No problem.
All right, thank you so much, Josh. Really appreciate you taking the time late in the evening the other day and to talk to us. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was good to hear you. Look forward to seeing you. If your plan comes to fruition, we should be catching up with you sometime May or June.
Yep. So what stood out for you? What caught your ear?
Well, a whole bunch of things. And one, Josh, if you want to fill in on the show anytime, I can just take a day off because you can we argue so many of the same points with John that sounded like
need you to pick up a 4x4 and conk me on the head here.
No, but I mean we have
cyber conking me here.
I haven't done that all week. Okay. Yeah, we have similar opinions on a few things which came out, and I was listening to that. But a few things. I mean, it's a good thing you weren't in court because, you know, you kept leading the witness. like, don't you think? And don't you think? And you kept going, no. it was fun to hear you two sort of trading opinions there, and I really enjoyed that. And one of the things that interested me, just touch on it, was how he used numbers and the kind of numbers he used and how he used them,
right,
as a kind of a roadmap, mm-hmm, to measure his progress, you know, as a guideline. Well, I'm not hitting most used to be 300 hitters, you get so many hits this week and did that game.
Yeah.
But when Trey Hillman came to Japan in 2003, he was coming out of that, the on-base percentage, slugging percentage revolution. You know, it swept through MLB or much of MLB in the late 90s. And he was like that. Trey said, you know, these are our on-base percentage targets. These are our slug targets. And Josh was like that. So, you know, I guess what he's saying is, you know, if my numbers aren't where they should be, it means I'm doing something wrong, or, you know, I have to find a reason why my numbers aren't where they should be.
Right.
And as opposed to a measure of what I'm actually doing, but sort of as a roadmap.
Yeah, I was expecting him to break down some real secret things, but then I thought about it, and probably it's not to his benefit to give out all the secrets because he's still playing. He intends to come back, and it made sense to me that he didn't give into too much detail. But he did say that, you know, he likes to see what the pitcher's walk rate is because he wants to know how close around the plate they're going to be, if they're going to hang out there, if they're going to be out of the zone a lot. So that piqued my interest there. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was about to touch on that because I felt the same. You know, that's an interesting approach because there's so many ways you can go after a player and look at a player, but you know, he sort of breaks it down into quadrants or sections. You know, what kind of pitcher? Okay, I'll do this plan or that plan, or I'll adjust it. I'll be thinking of a kind of approach depending on whether the guy is nearer the zone or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of interesting to me to see how he used those numbers. The other thing that caught my interest, of course, because you were talking about the Swallows, and of course the team I do watch more than others.
Well, with great interest you watch. Yes.
Yeah.
You're emotionally invested. Admit it. Yeah, I am. I understand it.
Not too much. The thing is that we had so many friends who were Swallows fans last year that we ended up going to a bunch of Swallows games on my days off.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the Swallows, Jingu's close to the Ramichan Cafe and so on and so forth. So I ended up going to a lot of Swallows games last
year.
And I heard what you were saying. You know, they play in this hitter's park, and they could use more power to take advantage of the hitter's park. And he was saying, no, if you got a whole lineup of guys who get on base, you don't really need big power hitters. And you're both absolutely right. The Swallows could really benefit from a guy who's another big hitter in the lineup, but they could also be really good if they had eight guys who got on base a lot. The problem is they don't have eight guys who get on base a lot. They got six.
When they're healthy, I mean, of course, we've seen over the past two seasons they've been feeding the injury bug solely.
Well, actually,
you know, they've been keeping them alive.
Indeed they have. And I was thinking, you know, of the players, you know, who do get on base. I mean, their catchers get on base a lot. And, of course, Coco Valentin got on base a ton. Millage gets on base a fair amount.
Mm-hmm.
Ihara gets on base. The new kid, the second baseman, Yamada's a dynamo. Kawabata had a superb, you know, 3 months or 2.5 months.
Aikawa gets on base a little bit, but he hits too.
Yeah, but these guys, first base was an issue, but basically they had big holes at short and in center field. And then I was thinking, well, you know, it occurred to me today when I was at Tokyo Dome for just a few minutes and I saw Yuhei Takai. And I thought, wow, wait, hold on, this guy can get on base. That's seven guys they have who can, you know, they basically get on base at seven positions. Shortstop still Morioka I like, but really that's all he does is get on base, and he's not that good at it. He's a good gap filler.
Mm.
But anyway, it occurred to me that Yuhei Takai could probably do that job. Now, Yuhei Takai is was converted to the outfield a few years ago. And he had a really good season in 2012 as he got more and more regular playing time. It proved this guy can really hit. And then 2013, I believe he got hurt on the first or second game of the season. We didn't see him all year. And speaking of the injury bug, I think Josh was talking about the pitchers getting the injury bug, but I think because Takai is a former pitcher, he probably wasn't immune to it.
Yeah, well, I looked at their pitching, and yes, their pitchers got hurt, but we know that Millage was out. We know that
Kawabata missed the first half of the season.
Aikawa had suffered injuries. I mean, they had injuries everywhere. It wasn't just the pitchers.
And the guys
he named were really good pitchers. I mean, Tateyama, Yoshinori. These are really good guys who...
Yoshinori hasn't been healthy for 2 years, so it's hard to say that they got hit last year.
Well, I began the conversation by saying the past 2 years, so I'm staying in that vein. And I think, you know, it hasn't just been one set of guys. It hasn't been all the pitchers who've gotten hurt. It hasn't been their big boppers who have gotten hurt. It hasn't been the little slap-and-run guys. It's just been a merry-go-round of guys going in and out of the lineup, and so they've had...
That doesn't sound like a very happy merry-go-round, unless you're one of the guys who's getting playing time.
There's more downs than ups in this thing somehow, and obviously they're going to have to put a lot of guys out there who can just, you know, slap the ball, hopefully get on base, and then, you know, you get on base, they're fast so they can steal, or when they get moved over, if they get in position, if you get that two-out single or any kind of single, they can get home with a run, and it's really good, but I just don't see that as a winning formula, a championship formula. Speed never has a slump.
The speed element
never really has a slump.
Intrigue me. What's the on base element? Because you don't need guys to hit for power if you don't make outs.
Yeah, well, you don't, but you, and the speed element is just, you know, the old-fashioned Ichiro who, when he got to the States, he would slap a ball to the infield and beat it out. And you can get your on-base percentage up with those little ground balls that, because they don't hit the ball so hard, because they're not big boppers, they can beat out more than the other guys. But, that, you know, that doesn't win you games all the time.
Well, like I said, it's all about getting on base. It's not about how you do it. It's about getting on base. So if they're, and like I said, they do, there are, they're pretty good at it. I mean, as what they're pretty good is in the sense they're not really bad.
Yeah, well.
I would say that in the Central League, they're probably about the third best team in this. They might be third or they might be fourth. They played at a very good hitter's park. They barely led the league in on base percentage, which is not a good sign. You play in a park like that, you want to lead the, you know, you want to be 10 points higher than the league instead of one.
Yeah. All right. Well, what else? What else got your ear there?
Well, I guess have to go on to the next round of our discussion about Masahiro Tanaka.
Okay. I got my gloves on. Go ahead. I'm all taped up. I'm ready to go.
Well, you know,
I'll give you the first blow.
Well, Josh already took it. So.
Well, Josh is a player, and I've never heard a player say that someone was overpaid. Except for you, Darvish, but we'll get to that in a second.
Well, my question for you, I mean, market value is an interesting concept. Now, you keep asserting that the Yankees overpaid, which means, to me, they had an option to pay less. Is that true? Could they have gotten him more cheaply?
Okay. And you, before I ask you the question, I have a statement to make then. How's that?
Okay, go ahead, make your statement.
All right, if you go into some place and you know the price,
right,
then you can decide whether to pay for it or not.
Right.
If you don't know the price,
right,
and you want to make sure you walk out of that thing there with that item and you know that other people are going to try to buy it too, you want the other people to get out of the room. And I think what they did is they paid extra money to get people out of the room.
Because,
so they made sure that they could buy the item.
Right, right. But
now, that doesn't mean that the item is worth that much.
Hold on. So you're saying that if they – hold on. So they could have got him more cheaply somehow.
Well, to answer your question
– I don't understand how they could have gotten him more cheaply.
To answer your question, yes, in essence, I think they didn't have to pay that much because what we heard were the – what I saw, what I've seen in print is that 125 to 130 – million was what people were talking about. 120 million to 130 million was about the price that people were talking about. And those numbers I've seen online in a couple of places. So okay. When you bring 155 million into the room, you're going to get rid of the competition. You're going to chase off the competition.
Okay. And so basically you're saying they overpaid by $20 million.
I'm not saying that they overpaid by 20 million. I'm saying they overpaid. Now, by how much,
okay.
We don't
so
know.
We're talking about a very.
We don't know how much because we don't know. I haven't seen any numbers on the other
okay.
offer.
That's, I'm interested in, that's kind of an interesting viewpoint I hadn't really considered. But again, I have to look at, you know, the people who are getting value from this are the Yankees. And we can, and I guess, of course, the real thing is whether they overpaid for him in a fair market is very hard to argue. Because, like I said, they were the ones who ended up with them, and that was the price they thought they needed to pay to get.
Well, I think they had two prices in mind. I think they had a price that they actually wanted to pay him and a price they wanted to pay to get the other people out of the room. And I don't think that value is all for Makun. I think part of the money,
then you're losing me because if they're going to pay more than they wanted – well, of course, sometimes you pay more than you want because the market price is higher than you expect.
Exactly.
This sounds like what you're saying.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just like when you go and you go to a fine dining establishment and you order lobster and it says market price. The market price changes.
Sure,
it changes on supply and demand. And here we have a supply and demand issue where there's only one Makun and there's the demand is that the Yankees walk away with him. And I think it drove the price up. And, you know, that's what I said. That's what I stopped Josh and I said, hey, you said it drove the price up. Are you saying that it's an overpay. And he said, well, you know, obviously he said what he said, which was, I don't think any player gets overpaid. But then again, I go back to you, Darvish, to bring up that example, because I've never heard anyone ever talk about another guy's salary, even in joking. And for him to make the statement, which was, I think they paid Tanaka too much money, and laugh it off, and if, expect people to not run, especially the U.S. press, to run away with that and take it to everybody else, and then have to the entire organization has to backpedal by issuing a statement to make sure everyone thinks or knows or reports that he was joking. We know he wasn't joking, because it affected him the most. His stuff apparently grades out higher than Monkun's, right?
It doesn't affect him.
It affects his pocket. I'm sure he thought it was his money.
Hold on. It affects him what? It'll affect him. He'll get a better contract next time. It's going to help him a lot. I think I saw Darvish coming with this. I saw this the second we began to understand that the market for Tanaka was going to be really hot because of the weakness, the few solid pitchers available in the U.S. So we saw that market was going to be exceedingly high. 2 years ago, the market wasn't anything like that for Darvish. And the payout turned out to be 40% less. You know, 40% less than Tanaka got, but the market was radically different.
Again, Yu Darvish's stuff grades out higher than Monkun's, they said.
I'm not buying it, but people say it.
Well, I mean, probably a little bit. It's all relative.
This is the thing. His stuff grades out, and he's bigger, and he's taller. And if you're a scout trying to sell a team, that's what most teams really all they care about is how fast is his fastball, how much movement does he get.
Right.
End of story. I'll tell you, you know, if it was how much velocity he gets on his fastball and how much movement he gets, Irabu would have been a big major league star.
Yeah, if it's all about that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I hear. Here's the direct quote. I don't know the details of the posting system, but I think the Yankees gave him a little bit too much.
Darvish.
I mean, come on. And that's through an interpreter, I didn't actually see exactly what he said.
I thought he was going to say that because I remember the stuff he was saying about Tanaka's record last year, which is, look, congratulations on your record, but you better know you would never have done it if I was still pitching in the Pacific League. So I'm thinking, okay, this guy's got he's having fun with him. I know they get along pretty well.
Yeah, they do.
He's having fun with him, but he's also, you know, he's letting one fly. He's given, thrown a little zinger in there. And of course, the answer is we don't know any of that. So I expected Darvish to get steamed by the fact that, you know, the $30 million that the Eagles didn't get, that the Fighters did, and some extra change went to Tanaka. You know, so he basically was in a situation that was disadvantageous to him.
Right.
And he certainly thinks he's a better pitcher. And there are scouts who believe he's a better pitcher.
Right.
But that's another thing.
Yeah.
But my thinking of this is no. The answer is, did they overpay? And whether their payment strategy, their optimal strategy for getting him was that this is the price we have to pay. Therefore, if it's the price we have to pay to get the other guys out of the room to keep it from going even higher or whatever it is, this is the price we have to pay. That is the price that has been put on Tanaka. Now, the next thing, you can say that's overpaid, but they didn't say, well, he's not worth, if they thought they were really overpaying, you know what they would have said? We're not going to pay that much. We've already hit our limit.
No, I think the Yankees, and I mean, they're desperate, okay? They were desperate for a pitcher.
Okay, so basically you're saying they're irrational.
I'm saying they were going to pay as much as they had to pay to get people out of the room. Now, here's another thing. Are there players here in MPB and in MLB who are underpaid?
Sure, tons of them.
So if there are people who are underpaid, aren't there people who are overpaid?
There are people. Okay, now here's the thing. They are overpaid relative to what? Not the day they sign the contract. Although in Japan, because of the seniority system,
mm-hmm.
you'll have a lot of the payment structure in Japan is set basically. So veteran players who are underperforming,
mm-hmm.
they can't get rid of these guys and they can't cut their salary very easily. It's a PR nightmare for most of these teams. So, that's why you needed a general manager like Hiromitsu Ochiai to come in and say, you're not going to get, we want you, but you know, we got to cut your salary by 2/3.
Yeah. All right. Well,
or you can take a hike. See, this is an American style thing, yeah. is a business style approach. But in Japan, it is very hard. So I think you do get players who are in that situation. They're on the downsides of big careers who have public relations issues. So that's another issue.
Okay. Well, there's people who there are players who are underpaid and overpaid everywhere. I just think they overpaid. I can't tell you. I can't put a figure on it.
Yeah. See, I don't buy that. And yeah. I don't buy that because they had a choice not to pay him at all. So
I don't think they did. I think they were desperate. They missed the playoffs. They need pitching. They don't even know how they're pitching. They weren't even sure what their pitching situation and still aren't, I don't think. Going to be going into the system. I think they wanted something that they thought was going to be a sure thing for the next 4 or 5 seasons, and they were willing to pay whatever, and including overpay it.
Would have been feasible for them.
If the going rate or people were talking about the figures going out there at the beginning were $150 million for him, they would have paid more.
If there were two teams who wanted to pay $170 million, then that's how much he's worth. I mean, I don't understand. Okay, now here's the thing. It's still, regardless of what you think about the Yankees' sanity, it's still their choice.
Okay.
It's like saying, well, I want this. They're not overpaying because there is value there that they can't get without paying it.
All right. Well, we got to move on.
Okay.
To
give you the point. Now, I agree in the sense when you talk about players who are getting paid too much, normally what you're talking about is players who do not match their expectations, the expected value returned.
Right.
Now that you can't know.
Underperforming the contract.
How much he's going to be worth to the Yankees.
Right. They're not performing to the contract.
I don't buy that. I don't buy that one. We just can't say. Okay.
Right.
That's my take.
All right.
Okay.
So, one other thing that caught my ear, and we'll move on to, talk about Malkin a little bit, is the amazing ability of some players to remember their numbers. And I asked Josh about 2012, not about 2013, because he didn't face Malkin then. I asked him about 2012, and off the top of his head, he came up with this 4-for-7, 2 doubles and 2 singles. And, just amazing. He said, and then he offered the information that in 2011, he was 0-for-4 off him. So these guys.
That doesn't surprise me. I see lots of athletes, not just baseball players, do that.
Well, I've seen golfers do that. You know, they can say, hey, in 2005 on the 16th hole, on this course, I hit a 5-iron, you know, with the wind blowing to the left. And I'm like, what?
It's just amazing. That's, I was stunned because I know like, players who will tell you, you know, not only what pitch they hit, what pitch and what was the count, what was the weather of, you know, but they can tell you whether, you know, which socks they were wearing.
And who was playing, who was playing in the field, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Like, you know, who was, you know, with the name of the chick sitting behind a third base dugout, you know? So I was shocked one time I interviewed Norichi Aoki, and I asked, he hit 3 of his home runs. He hit 13 home runs, his second full season.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit 3 of them off lefties. And I said, you know, who'd you hit them off of? And he didn't have a clue. He was like the ball player from another planet. I've never met an athlete who didn't just have this stuff ingrained in their memory.
Yeah.
And he was like, nope. I hit 3. I think they were 3 off lefties. I don't remember who it was.
All right. So, one of the Yomiuri reporters asked me the other day when I went to talk to them, what they thought Ma Kun was going to do in the States. And he had a nice debut, or a very strong debut, early Sunday morning, 2 innings, 3 strikeouts for the Yankees.
Early Sunday morning in Japan.
In Japan, yes. Of course, we always use Japan time. Hey.
Okay. we're biased that way.
So they asked me how he's going to do. And I said, hey, look, I don't know how he's going to do because there are too many variables.
Sure.
I don't know who the shortstop is going to be the entire season.
If you didn't know, there's still too many variables.
Yeah, I don't know what they're going to look like on defense. The bullpen has questions, including the back of the bullpen. It's a tough division. He's going to be facing some really tough teams. Who's going to stay healthy? But I said,
if you did know all that, you still wouldn't know.
Exactly. So I said, you know, I think he can keep his ERA in the threes, maybe lower, but we'll see. It just depends. And then 12 to 14 wins, maybe. I said, really strong rookie season.
Very possible.
You know, I can see that happening. I don't know. What do you expect? I did say this, though, that I don't expect a Hideo Nomo-type rookie season because he's not that deceptive. Nomo was so deceptive and nobody really seen anything like it before. And they spent most of the time trying to look for the ball, not so much hit it as just try to find out where it is.
Oh, did I tell you my Barry Larkin story about Nomo?
No.
Barry Larkin is...
Hall of Famer Barry Larkin.
When they need him, he's the former Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame shortstop, and now, from time to time, he's the manager of the Brazilian national team. He's a great teacher and a great communicator in mm-hmm. terms of breaking things down. And he said, you know, baseball, whatever it is you're doing, you can break it down into its parts. And if there are things normal people can do, anybody can do it. 99% of the time it is. And he says, he struggled looking at Hideo Nomo. It took him a long, long time until he figured out essentially all – what he had been doing and what most of the players were doing was trying to pick up the ball by studying this top on the mound, the spinning top. and he realized that the ball was always coming the same place. He said, I just wait, bam, the ball's there, here it comes. So he learned how to time Nomo basically by not looking at the windup.
But it takes a long time. Yeah,
It took some time. Yeah. It took some study. So that's going to happen. It's going to happen both ways. People are going to be mystified by him. He's going to make mistakes. What do I think? I think I'm right in there with you. I think he could win. The most likely result is that he goes, and again, here we don't know, but
yeah, take a shot.
I think 12 and 9, or, you know, depending on the team, but in that area, 3 point something or 3 point, I mean, Kuroda had a 3.81 ERA last year, who's a guy who's more used to the league, but I think his stuff is, Tanaka's stuff will play better. I'm going to say 3.6, 3.6, 3.7 ERA. I wouldn't be surprised to see him win 18. I wouldn't be surprised to see him win 18 games. I wouldn't be too surprised. I'd be surprised to see him win 20. And I would be pretty surprised to see him not win 10.
Yeah, I think double digits we can count on just about. And
I'm going to guess he's going to have a winning record, although it might be close.
Yeah, we'll have to see. We'll see. It'll be interesting. Okay, let's talk about some Japanese baseball. We've had a couple of... 2 weekend days of spring preseason games, mm-hmm. 3 days, 3 games on both days, I think it was, or do we have 4 on Saturday? And, not much, nothing too dramatic is going on so far. But I did see that Shohei Tateyama of the Yakult Swallows had to leave his game last week and was experiencing discomfort in the surgically repaired elbow that he's had 2 Tommy Johns on, right?
Yep.
And I wouldn't wish any more under the knife situations for that guy. And I didn't like what I saw. And I don't like any talk of discomfort in that elbow.
Yeah, especially, you know, not with, that's tendon replacement. Is it ligament?
Ligament
replacement.
Japan,
the captain of the Japanese national soccer team is going under a similar one. He had some ligament repair done in his knee, and then he went back to train, and it doesn't feel right, so he was going to be out for 3 weeks, 6 weeks, and then he went back to train, and it doesn't feel right, and he had surgery, he's going to be out for 10 more weeks, and the Tommy John is basically a one-year deal, and Tateyama was one of the, I wouldn't say, I'm not going to rank him, you know, 1 to 5, but he was one of the 5 best pitchers in the Central League for several years. So, he could easily have been the best pitcher in the Central League from 2005 to 2010. And, that's a really tough blow for the Swallows. They were a guy they were counting from. So we'll see how that plays out. Hopefully it's just, a rest issue or a minor inflammation that'll go away with rest.
Hopefully. Then Seibu, Saitama Seibu, slugger, Okawari-kun, Takuya Nakamura.
How's he doing?
He had a rib cage injury, and they were just going to rest him. And I think, once you get that, the rib cage thing, whether it's a tweak or I didn't see if it was what he was saying, but, they say it's tightening up or it's strained or a slight strain or a pull. But I think that means at least a week or so, maybe 10 days with no swinging, because you can't pick up a bat and swing it with a ribcage injury. So
you got to rest it.
Yep. And he hasn't played a lot of games over the past 2+ seasons. So I'm kind of concerned about that and his health, and trying to take that into consideration while I assess the Lions this off season or this preseason. Yeah. But
he probably tried to do. He came back late at the end of the season, and he was he didn't play the infield, but he did hit, and he hit. He began to really pick up the pace towards the end of the season. Hit some big bombs for them.
Yeah, but they need him to play. 120, 110, 15, somewhere in there.
So again, that's the same thing. I think he was probably pushing it too hard in spring, trying to come back and hit 50 home runs or break Ballantyne's record. He was probably pushing it a little too hard, and wasn't able to carry that workload. So he's probably got to tone it back. I hope he'll be fine. Hoping it's just a strain and not a tear, and it's not a lot of inflammation. A couple of weeks to just, go back to square one and calm down. Get that guy to calm down. Of course, they got the perfect manager, Ihara. I love Ihara, but man, he's like, I don't know what he's about as patient as a stopwatch. He's like, go.
All right, and then Yokohama DeNA's Sho Aranami, an outfielder, he broke a finger trying to catch a little fly ball to center the other day, and he's going to miss 6 weeks. And not that he's a real big impact player with the Bay Stars, but he gets on base.
And he's a good player.
And he's a good solid player. And
you're the Bay Stars. You can't afford to be losing good players. I mean, they have a lot of spare parts.
Yeah, but I thought if anywhere they could afford an injury, it's probably catcher and outfield, because they have a lot of all of those. So, as long as it's not one of the pitchers who can actually pitch and get guys out and is consistent, then I think.
Do they have one of those this year?
Don't know.
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Maybe the pitching coach, Miura, Daisuke Miura. But
he can get people out.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Okay. Now, Hanshin closer, the new closer. What's his?
Osun Juan.
I want to call him Juan, Juan Gonzalez or Juan Martinez.
You call him Juan.
He looks really good. He looks the part of a stopper, and I heard an interview with him the other day where he kind of joked around with the media too. So he's got some personality, which is really nice.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, a lot of us would like some personality. I wonder where he got his. I saw a little bit the other day. His agent was talking to, the media about his emotion and saying that he'd had people from the major leagues clear it and say it would be viable in the U.S. Their questions about
is it a double clutch
legality. I don't know what it is. I see, and again, I've seen video, but I haven't seen it recently. I haven't seen it since I saw that comment in the media here, and it occurred to me that this is almost an annual thing in Japan. People coming from other leagues, and the umpires, they always. what they'll do in one of the things they do in spring training is they check pitchers' deliveries to make sure the umpires say they're legal and they're not balking.
Right.
Okay. And it reminded me, you know, one of the rules, one of the pet rules, in Japan is the balk rule. And in Japan, the balk rule, as it's written, says a pitcher must pause a discernible length of time, and it must be his standard length of time before he goes to the mound. Before he goes to the mound, goes to the plate, excuse me, before he delivers to the home plate. And in Japan, that is identified as must be at least 3 seconds. So in America, every pitcher has his own unique motion. If he works quickly, he works quickly. And they say that's normal. He's not deceiving. But in Japan, if you don't have the 3 seconds, then you're breaking the law, and they're out to string you up. And the umpires, Masato Yoshi told me, I asked him if that was a problem when he came back. And he said, you know what? We talked to the umpires all spring, in camp, in the preseason. Everybody said, fine, fine, fine. What you're doing is fine. Third game of the year, I'm starting, and that's a balk. You know, basically the same thing had been good in camp. Katsuhiko Miyagi, who was an all-star outfielder for the Hawks and a big part of some of the Lions' successful teams early, about 12 years ago, was a high school pitcher with a weird motion, and he was cleared in spring training. Masahiko, so it's probably Higashio, Osamu Higashio, made sure the umpires checked his motion and cleared it in spring training. First day of camp, bingo. First day of the season, bingo, yeah. This guy can't pitch in this league. And he couldn't pitch any other way. So come his first fall camp, they said, hey, when you're coming, bring your outfielder's glove. So this happens every year. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see. I think we'll find out on opening day.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, he looks the part. He looks like a really good, I mean, I like his motion. I like his movement on his pitches. And from what I've seen, I haven't really seen that much yet, but I liked what I saw already. So let's move on and talk about the commissioner. And we didn't get asked this question, but I was on the train the other day and I posed it to myself and I thought, when is MPB going to have a Posey rule? Essentially, and you know, we know that the major leagues implement or are going to try to implement a non-collision rule at home plate this season. Now, you know, for all this talk, the simple thing that I thought was, why don't they enforce the rule the way it's written, and then we wouldn't have this problem. If you're a catcher and you don't have the ball, you cannot impede the runner. And right. that would eliminate a lot of the collisions, because sometimes guys are sitting on home plate thinking they're going to get the ball before it comes, and they're hit before the ball gets there or right when the ball gets there.
Right. And essentially that strategy is the guy slides, he loses his moment. The catcher sets up about anywhere from 6 inches up the third base line to a few feet. And basically the guy runs into him, the ball arrives, the guy is dead in the water, and he tags him out. And to play, the catcher is now allowed to spike the ball, especially if that was the third out.
Right.
Okay. The rule basically says that the rule John is referring to is the rule that says the catcher cannot impede the runner. The only time the catcher can impede the runner is if he must be between the runner and the base to catch the ball, which is almost never happens, that you have to be in the baseline to catch the ball.
Yeah.
Because balls aren't dropping straight from the sky. They're coming on traveling on some sort of arc or a line, which means you can be behind the baseline, you can be in front of the baseline. You don't have to be on the line. So it's almost never a case. But anyway, so in that case, the runner would be safe. And that is what they're going to do, is say that if the catcher does not have the ball and he attempts to block the runner, if he intends to keep the runner from having a clear shot at home plate and scoring, the runner will be safe regardless.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what happens after that. The umpire says you're safe, which is great. And contrary, if the catcher has the ball but is not blocking the plate, and they decide that the runner is trying to be safe, you know, cover all his bets, you know, by knocking the ball loose from the catcher.
Right. Dislodging.
And he veers out of the baseline to go after the catcher, that the runner's automatically out.
Yeah.
Which I think, oh, that makes sense to me. I mean, think how the other plays work at third base. You know, the ball, the runner comes in, the ball comes in. The catcher, the guy's got to catch the ball and apply the tag. The catcher should just try to catch the ball and apply the tag. End of story. No problem.
Yeah, well, I know what you said about the other bases, and no other base can a runner plow into a fielder who's trying to catch the ball.
Well, that's not the thing. At every base they can. There's no rule that says they can't. They just don't. They don't.
Well, the reason is because home plate is a different animal. You're not trying to. It's the only base you never stand on. I mean, you don't stand on home base to be safe. You have to stand on the other bags to be safe when.
But if you try to dislodge the ball from another fielder at another base, they will call you out.
Yeah.
If the guy has the ball and you do an Alex Rodriguez and you swat it out of his glove, they will still call you out.
That's not my point. My point is that you're not running through the bag. You're stopping at the bag. Whereas at home plate, you're just trying to touch it. And so because you're not trying to land there, you're moving at a higher rate.
Like I said, there's no rule that prevents a runner from giving a second baseman an elbow, you know, blow to the head to knock the ball loose.
Right.
And coming up, not sliding, and just, you know, going down and attacking him. There's no rule against that.
That man accosted me.
No, I mean, essentially that. Because that's what we have permitted with catchers, is that if the catcher has the ball, then it's okay to take his head off.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether he's standing in the line or not.
All right.
If he's standing close to the line, he's fair game. So I think, now there are going to be issues because, and plant catchers will still be allowed to, you know, I expect A.G. Przinski to get the ball and block the plate, in which case the runner now has the license to go after you.
Yeah. Well, and so they will go after
him. I think
him.
You'll still see some of that.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering, because I know at some point MPB, you know, the rules try to mirror the MLB rules, and I know at some point I think they'll expand instant replay to the level that it has been expanded in the States, and they'll also bring in the challenge rule and allow managers to challenge at some point. So we'll look for those rule changes pretty soon.
I expect that. You did ask me, and I guess tell the listeners that it's not NPB. It's not actually NPB that changes the rules. I didn't know this.
Mm.
Mr. Matsuzaki, the excellent and overworked tonight, I'm sure he is underpaid, PR man for NPB, told me that it's not NPB that makes the rules. It's instead the Japan Baseball Rules Committee, the JBRC, which is staffed mostly with NPB people, but also people from the amateur federations. And they're the ones who make the rules. So there you go. So he said, talk to they're mostly umpires, actually. There's a couple of official scorers, a bunch of umpires, a team's representative, head of the Amateur Baseball Federation. So basically it's a group effort. It's all of Japan's, baseball, federations getting together to decide the rules. But you're right. They do mirror MLB, and they've mirrored MLB. One year they were going to, MLB introduced a draconian balk rule. The only problem was there were so many balks, the games were slowing down and everybody got bored to tears. So that was in March, and they gave up on that rule in the middle of April. And NPB had said on opening day, we're going to do this next year. And then, of course, in June, they said, no, thank you.
Yeah, let's skip that, yeah.
Yeah, they almost got whiplash. They were following them too closely.
Well, I'll be happy when they expand replay. And I think we talked before we started taping, and you said they were going to add replay on balls that maybe catches up against the wall to see if the ball actually hit the wall or not. And that's probably pretty good. And I expect them to implement these rules, but right now, the way it is in the major leagues, I think the challenge rule is kind of confusing to some of the managers. I read a quote the other day that one manager said he's just going to try and challenge everything until they tell him to stop and see what he did, you know, to test everything out. And I think this rule too, with the collisions, is kind of fuzzy. And I think MPB can sit back and watch and see what happens. And when it all gets all corrected and it's, you know, the testing period is over, then they can implement it here.
Well, one of the things about the collision that's kind of interesting is that it meshes with the video replay, because all plays at the plate will now be reviewable.
Yeah.
And not reviewable, not challengeable, but the umpires can review them if they want to.
If they want to, yeah. Okay. All right, well.
And actually, they're not even going to review. The umpires aren't going to review them. They're going to be reviewing them in New York, where Joe Torre and his posse will be there, you know, watching all the games and having their chicken sandwiches and their beer. And somebody comes on the video, "Hey, Joe, stop it. We got a collision on the plate."
Isn't it fried chicken? Isn't it fried chicken and beer, not chicken sandwiches?
It might be fried chicken. I'm not certain, although with Joe, it's probably more likely to be linguine, but yeah, they'll be chowing down and says, "Okay, I look safe. Give me another beer."
All right, let's go to fielding questions. All right, this question comes from Benjamin, and he said, "I was wondering what smoking culture on teams and in the clubhouse is like in MPB. I know times are changing, but Japan has always been extremely smoker-friendly. I think I recall reading in Cromartie's autobiography that many of his teammates were chain smokers. What was the atmosphere in MPB like when you first came to Japan, and how is it now? And how does it compare to the chaw culture in the U.S.? Just something I've always wondered about. Thanks in advance, and keep up the good work." All right, Benjamin, well, thank you for the questions. Geez.
Go ahead.
I can tell you this, that I didn't know what the smoking culture was like on teams when I arrived so much in Japan in 1990. And when I started to cover games, I did know where the guys were smoking behind the bench, because there's a special area for the players to smoke. So they don't have to, I mean, there was no, first of all, there were no, when Nagoya Dome opened in 1997, I went there and I could smell the smoke. There was no smoking allowed in any other area in the park, only where the players were allowed to smoke back behind the bench. And I would smell smoke, and I'm like, "What's going on here? There's no smoking in this dome. It's brand new. What is going on?" And someone said, "Oh, the players get to smoke in this particular area." So that was in 95. And I can't tell you about some of the other locations, but the ones in Tokyo that I've been to.
That was in 97, you mean?
Yeah, that was in 97. But when I got this job and moved to Tokyo in 2005 and was started going to most of the parks out here, Seibu, Jingu, Tokyo Dome, sometimes Chiba, I can smell smoke in a lot of areas in those parks. And I know out at Seibu Dome, the visitors area to smoke is always crowded with players and former players and coaches. And
oh yeah, that little alcove. Well, actually, right. That little alcove down the first base side, right behind the camera pit. It's you got to walk past.
You got to hold your breath.
Yeah.
And then Hisanobu Watanabe, the former Seibu manager, used to smoke all the time, like before games. In part because he was nervous, I heard. He was really nervous and he'd chain smoke at some point just before the game started. And you could smell it very strongly there. And he was managing up until last season. And at Jingu, it's pretty bad. So, I mean, you know, I get surprised when I see some of these players and I talk to them and then I see them in these smoking areas. It's very shocking to me that these professional athletes, high priced, highly paid, highly skilled people smoke cigarettes. But, I think
it's the culture and Benjamin had it right. There is still this culture that comes out of the high schools and, you know, I don't know if you Darvish is still smoking, but
yeah, remember I called him, I nicknamed him the smoking gun because he was suspended his first year with the Nippon Havarti before he even pitched in a game for smoking.
For underage smoking.
Yeah, for smoking underage. And as you recall, the story was one of those magazines or newspapers or weekly magazine or some periodical. Someone followed him and took a picture of him smoking and playing pachinko. And had it in their publication, and that's how it was known that he was underage smoking, and he got suspended by the team. So, and this was a teenage Darvish. So, the guy I used to call the smoking gun, he's outgrown that, but, he has, how does it compare to the Chaw culture in the U.S.? And my answer to that is I would hope that the Chaw culture in the U.S. is diminishing. And I haven't seen as much as I did when I was a kid watching baseball in the 70s, and I saw just about everybody spitting and with a face full of chud or crud or whatever you want to call it. And I think Lenny Dykstra was the guy for me in the 80s. I mean, his cheeks were busting loose with Chaw, and I've never seen anybody like that since then.
Well, Trey, you know, we had a couple of managers here who did chew. Trey Hillman chewed, and Lenny Cicada, who was a coach here with the Lotte Marines for a while, he chewed. And you pretty much, with Lenny, you kind of had to watch your feet.
Nice.
Trey always carried a cup, you know, and complained about his habit, you know, which is what polite people do when they have incredibly bad habits. So, and Trey's as polite as they come. So, yeah, it is. The smoking thing is a Japanese, high school. I think it comes out of the Japanese high school sports cultures. These kids, so many of them do smoke, and they all know it's bad for them, and they all pretty, I would venture to guess that half the players are chain smokers. It might be smaller. I don't think it's appreciably changed much.
You mean on the professional level or in the high school level
say at the professional level.
Okay. Yeah.
I'd say, if it's, it might have been what, if it's changed, it might have been 65%, 70%, 20 years ago, and it's 65% now or 60%. So it would seem to be changing. Society is changing, but, high school baseball doesn't seem to have changed much. High school soccer, the foreign soccer players come to Japan are in shock when they see their teammates chain smoking, but that's what happens.
Yeah. I would play basketball, and I play on a team, a club team, and in between, you know, sometimes we have a day where we have two games, and in between games, the guys would go out and have a smoke, and I'm like, what are you doing?
I got too much oxygen in my lungs. I gotta take care of that.
Wow. All right. Well, let's take care of Benjamin and say thank you for sending in the question. We really appreciate it. It was a great question.
We do indeed, Benjamin. Next time, I don't want to berate your effort because it was quality. Next time, MP3, if you can, we want to hear your voice. We want everyone to hear you.
Please
let your voice be heard.
Yes, like Jim.
Never happened, man.
Yeah. Send an MP3 or an email to us at yakyujohn@gmail.com, or you can leave us a note on the Facebook page. And I've been more active, and we have new artwork. So check out our new artwork when you look up the podcast on iTunes, and let us know what you think.
All right. Well, thank you very much, John, for this evening.
Thank you very much, sir. And starting next time, which is going to be on March 17th, we are going to be weekly, as our title says we are.
As our title. So we'll try to be strongly weekly.
Strongly weekly. Don't say that too weekly. Say it strongly.
Indeed.
Okay. All right.
Well, so John can have the last word. I'll say thanks for listening, and we'll catch up with you next time.
All right. Enjoy your baseball.